Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Say you're a scientist and you want to stick electrodes in someone's brain. Piece of cake, right?
Having electrodes implanted in the brain is actually a really rare thing.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and I dropped in recently on David Caldwell at the University of Washington's Center for Neurotechnology.
You can find volunteers to put an electrode cap on the head, so you just, you know, offer a gift card and college students will come running for that. But when it comes to having electrodes directly implanted in the brain, we're not yet able to take volunteers for that.
It's got to be like a major gift card for that.
Exactly, it would have to be a very big one.
But seriously, that's not even like generally permitted, right?
Exactly. There currently, to my knowledge, is not really a mechanism for people to volunteer for these electrode implants.
The reason the bioengineers here want to do this is to help someone with, say, a prosthetic arm regain their sense of touch. It sounds a little sci-fi, but scientists have already designed prostheses that can be controlled by the user's thoughts, which is crazy. And now the trick is to engineer that signal in reverse.
You can imagine using your thoughts to move a robot arm external to your body, but how do you get information from that robotic arm back into your brain that tells you when it's, you know, touched a person's hand or is picking up an egg?
The idea is that if you wire the limb directly into the right part of the brain, and then a sensor in the hand sends back a signal, the person should actually feel something. So how do you test that if you're not allowed to saw into a volunteer's head? Well, you find people whose heads have been opened up already. In this case, people having brain surgery for epilepsy.
The patients are immobilized often in the bed, so they have this ponytail of cables coming out of their head in this head wrap, which connects to the electrodes that are implanted in the brain. And so,
What is the electrode? What does the thing look like?
So a electrode array, so this is, you can imagine the size of a cocktail napkin, and it's a clear rubbery material that has little circular metal discs embedded in it. And so there are about 64 of these discs in an 8x8 arrangement in this cocktail napkin.
So the napkin sits on the surface of the brain, and by zapping different electrodes on it, the researchers can figure out where the precise spot to stimulate is. And then when they find it,
We ask them to tell us, and it's pretty amazing, kind of the first time that they feel, you know, oftentimes you're very surprised when they have this, you know, what feels like a brushing or a buzzing on some part of their hand.
This is a ways off, but once they learn more, researchers are hoping to restore this basic human experience to people who have lost it.
The end goal would be to have a device that they didn't even have to think really about using, but just felt like a natural extension of their body that both allowed them, for instance, to shake a loved one's hand and then also to feel that touch.
Didn't they already solve this in Empire Strikes Back?
As I remember from that movie, they did.
At the end of that movie, you see Luke Skywalker with a robot arm and the medical droid or whatever that's doing the implant. Gives him a little prick on the palm, and he reacts. He feels it. And that's kind of what you're going for.
So I think we'll need to talk to George Lucas and figure out his secret.
For today's show, our theme is augmented reality, using machines or chemicals or the Force to change how we take in the world. That's in store on Sound Effect from KNKX. Having an amputation can quickly shrink a person's world, and technology, whether it's a high-tech brain interface or just a really well-made leg, can sometimes reopen that wider world.
Oh, God. From the age of maybe 2 to until I was 7, I must have had like 11 or 12 surgeries to try to fix my legs.
This is Stuart Olson. He lives in Seattle and works in IT.
I have a disability called Larson syndrome. All the joints, there's something wrong with them. They're bending in the wrong direction, they are a little fatter in some spots, so the joints are not perfect. So they tried to fix them, they kind of worked well for some time, but then...
Well enough for you to walk?
Yes, I was able to walk without them, but then my left leg started bending the opposite direction. so it looked like duck legs.
Stuart grew up in Bulgaria, and like a lot of children with disabilities there, he was raised in an orphanage. At that time, Bulgarian institutions were kind of notorious for kids' living conditions. Stuart doesn't have a ton to say about that. As you'll hear, he's a pretty unsentimental guy. But his life changed dramatically when, at age 15, he was adopted by an American couple and moved to Vashon Island.
At 15, all I knew about was the orphanage, and I always thought that the Bulgarian border was as far as I can see from the orphanage. So then we had, for the first time ever, I went on a plane, which I've never been to, and it was just, like, crazy. It's like, and what made it weirder is, like, all the different people you saw on the plane as well. We're in an orphanage, we're isolated from people, we know people here and there, but that's about it. And as soon as, like, you go to the capital of Bulgaria, Sofia, and you realize how diverse the world is. When we landed in the States, we were so exhausted, I vaguely actually remember anything. Like, I remember New York barely. We came in, like, at 2 in the morning, I think, to SeaTac, and we went home, and that's it. And the beauty of the Vashon Island is so small, so you don't get your senses overloaded right away.
Well, that's helpful. Ease into it a little bit.
Yeah.
Did you have prosthetics at that time?
No, I did not. So we took some x-rays and stuff like that, and Children's Hospital doctor said, we can't fix it. We have to amputate them. And at the time, I didn't speak any English. So to me, it was like whatever my parents said, that's how it went. And I just went along with it. I didn't question anything. I kind of understood things, but not to the point I can argue or question things. So it was all in their hands, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you remember having a feeling about it one way or the other?
No. No. I don't want to say I was numb about the whole experience, just I was still getting used to people in general, understanding them, culture, and all that stuff. Let's just go along with it and whatever.
It must have been just mixed in with all the other disorienting stuff about coming to a new country when you're a teenager. Yeah.
Yeah. And so mid-July, we went to the hospital, and they did all the surgeries in one day. So they amputated the left leg. They amputated the right foot. They broke a bone between the foot and the knee. And I think maybe 2 months after that, I was standing on a table with 2 prosthetic legs.
Wow.
Yeah. To me, the transition after the surgery, before I started wearing the legs, was, I don't know, kind of seamless. It's just another surgery.
And you seem pretty matter-of-fact about it. You felt that way at the time, too? You didn't feel like you were grieving for part of yourself or anything like that?
No. And I think one reason is because, and that's an interesting question, actually, because my legs didn't work very well. So to me, getting them amputated, it's a solution that, in the end, be better off. At the time, I didn't know how good it would be, but it's just, okay, we amputated them, let's see what happens next.
Yeah. So what was it like to get those prosthetics for the first time?
It was the hardest thing I think I ever done. And I had a physical therapist every afternoon after school. We first started trying to stand up on a table, like put the hands on the table and stand like a normal person. And that was so exhausting. I've never used so much energy just to stand up on legs. And then slowly, she kept pushing me to do other things. So it took me 3.5 years between the time I got up from a wheelchair and stood next to a table and held with 2 hands for my dear life until I fell down on the ground and got up with no problem.
Early on, by the way, you must fall sometimes. And so what was that for you when you fell?
Because of my disability, I cannot bend my right leg all the way through. It stops about 90 degrees. And when I was learning how to walk, my muscles were very weak. So anytime I fell and bended more than the 90 degrees, it will break usually. So those are the falls I remember. The rest of them, I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I was able to get up and just shrug it off as nothing. And now when I fall, it's like, oh, whatever.
early on, as you were learning how to use them, what was your relationship with your prostheses like? Did you love them, hate them? Did you think of them as a tool or as part of you or what?
Early on, it was a burden. You have to put them on, try to get up. But then I saw a picture, I think we went to Disneyland or somewhere, and I saw a picture of me with legs sitting next to my parents. And to me, that's where I think the reward is. It's like, it looks like you don't have any artificial legs.
How many prosthetics have you had in your life?
Three or four.
Three or four individual or pairs?
We don't never change them at the same time.
Okay, so three or four total.
I believe so. Maybe, let's say five. Let's say five. Leg is a leg at the end of the day. I have always joked about being amputated at the legs is probably the luckiest thing as a disability. Because legs are one function only. They just for walking. They're not solving puzzles. They're not doing anything. They're to get you from point A to point B. Sports, I can do it with a wheelchair. I can go skiing with a monoski. I don't need the legs to enjoy sports. I really don't.
And do you ski?
Yes, I do. I just got my own monoski. And my friend and I went four or five sessions with Outdoors for All. And I'm hoping next year to go by myself. But I'm still learning how to do it. So I don't want to take the risk yet.
Yeah. How much has the technology advanced since you started wearing prosthetics?
So the latest things for me have been my feet. I have little rotators so that I can stand, my feet can be flat on the ground and I can move my hips around and swing a little bit because the feet have rotators at the top, which give me that ability. I just got new ankles that 4 or 5 degrees of movement. It sounds very little, but it's pretty impressive when you go up a hill and down a hill.
Right.
But I think what I have works for me.
If you could invent whatever technology you wanted for your prosthesis to make improvements and make your life easier, what would they be?
I think it's to improve the fit of the leg and to be smart enough to change during the day. So the fit is always comfortable so that I can walk without thinking about maybe the leg might come off. When you start sweating, it starts moving inside a little bit and stuff like that. So it becomes very uncomfortable over the day. So having a way to stick to the skin and be solidly fit all day, that is, when they invent something like this, that's when I'll be extremely happy.
Stuart Olson lives in Seattle. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is augmented reality. Mental health struggles come in all shapes and sizes, as do their treatments. Even with about 1 in 8 Americans taking some form of antidepressant, there's still unease about these medications. Some people worry about taking a pill that could change their personality. For others, the illness is the altered state, and medicine is what allows their mind to get back to normal. Seattle writer Sarah Ann Lloyd has spent years seeing doctors, trying medications that may help in one area but hurt in another. After experiencing the complicated effects of these drugs, she began to wonder what her normal reality was anymore. She shared this essay.
I've been on and off drugs for decades. The pharmaceutical kind, for my brain. When I was 13 or 14 years old, and before my doctors looked too closely, the diagnosis was garden variety depression and generalized anxiety disorder, also known as you have a lot of panic attacks, and we're not entirely sure why. And it was really hard to prove any different. I was terrible at keeping both mood logs and therapists. I was taking SSRIs, one of the most common families of antidepressants. But they can also trigger mania, which can show up as an animated, elevated mood. In retrospect, that was the case for me. And I took it as a sign that the pills were working. when I would crash later, it would just seem like a bad fit. Bipolar disorder is more likely to be misdiagnosed as major depression in women. Maybe because of hormonal cycles, or because of everyday sexism. And bipolar disorder often comes with a side of ADHD. And that's even more likely to be missed in girls. So when, in my very early teens, a normal onset age for ADHD in girls, much later than boys, I went from a voracious reader who couldn't even look up from a book to cross the street to just skimming my way through every school assignment. I thought it was personal failure. That's how I didn't end up on my current medication cocktail until my 30s. Escitalopram, an antidepressant, wards off my panic attacks, helped along by an as-needed emergency panic pill. Lamotrigine, an anticonvulsant that can also treat bipolar, stabilizes my mood, keeping me from falling too low like a trapeze net while reining in my hypomania, that's elevated mood, on the other side. A therapist figured that one out after routinely seeing me excitedly falling all over myself talking, barely able to have a string of coherent ideas, only to slink in with sweatpants and silence at my next appointment. And then there's the newest addition to my pill case, levoamphetamine and dextroamphetamine, commonly known as Adderall, because a doctor finally saw my inability to focus as something that maybe couldn't be solved with cognitive behavioral therapy. I've gotten to know myself pretty well over the last 3 decades without these mood stabilizers and pharmaceutical speed. But the person I've known for those 3 decades is frequently out of touch with reality. A couple of moments from my late teens stand out to me pretty vividly. The first was when I was about 17, waiting alone for a bus in West Seattle. And I looked up at the sky, and suddenly my whole world was this big, empty vastness, like the eerie silence of an atom bomb in a movie. Nothing was empirically wrong. My feet were on the ground, I was physically healthy, I had everything I needed for the day, but I was overwhelmed and I was detached, floating above reality looking down. And it felt insurmountable. A couple of years later, I stumbled from my dorm room to the student health center with a sharp, aching coldness in my chest. I was given a clean bill of health and a psychiatrist's business card. It was the biggest panic attack I had had so far, by a long shot. So I white-knuckled it for a few years, with miniature versions of that major panic episode, sometimes daily. I was constantly taking my pulse, getting dizzy spells, trying to shake off a seemingly permanent feeling of impending doom. This fight-or-flight feeling, this tightness in my chest, this being absolutely sure I am dying when I'm not, it's so detached from reality. So is racking up credit card debt like it's Monopoly money during a high, or getting so low I can barely make a frozen pizza, much less leave the house or my bed. But the thing I grapple with, looking back over, again, 3 decades of untreated and undertreated mental illness, is that this is my reality. I've taken drugs that, I'll just say, were not prescribed by a doctor to help me cope with my sometimes overwhelming world. Then I was on drugs, in the reefer madness sense. But what am I doing now? I'm still on drugs. Drugs that affect my mind, even though I had to do a lot of work on myself to get there. It helps that I have the luxury of not self-medicating. I have insurance and experience navigating the medical system when not everyone does. So, which version of me is the altered state? Is the me with undiagnosed mental illness the original or the remix? What about the me that's functional, but with a little chemistry added to bring me back to Earth? Yeah, I know we're always growing as human beings. I was never going to be the same person I was at 17 or in college, mentally ill or no. But it's still the question of my wiring that I can't shake. I could still get that same bus stop feeling, where I'm floating above my own reality with an unshakable feeling of dread, from a, like, medium to bad acid trip. Is my rescue Xanax, which some people take recreationally, actually my anti-drug? And it's the attention deficit thing that maybe gets to me the most. If I weren't too terrified by my daily panic attacks to take Adderall in college to study, I would have been considered altered. But it turns out that I actually, really, clinically needed it to study. Who knew? I had been trying to claw my way toward normalcy, but it turns out there's just been something in the way the whole time. I realized the amphetamines were actually fixing some of my wiring when I managed to read for pleasure again. Not just read for pleasure, but read 2 books cover to cover in 4 days. Reading had been one of my lifelong loves, but it's embarrassing to admit, I hadn't read multiple books that quickly in 20 years. But, as we all know, your best self isn't typically your true self. Things aren't perfect. My cocktail probably isn't even perfect. I'll probably be adjusting that my whole life. I'm still adjusting the amphetamines because, hey, it turns out speed has some pretty potent effects. And so, I've started to think that there's no part of us that isn't altered in one way or another. Like, maybe I'm just as augmented when I'm sober in the middle of the day as when I wind down with some pot or a glass of wine in the evening, and that I'm just capable of different things and have access to different parts of my brain. Or maybe that's just the drugs talking.
Sarah Ann Lloyd is a writer in Seattle. This is Sound Effect, and our theme today is augmented reality. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. From time immemorial, people have been searching for ways to expand their reality using psychedelic drugs. Of course, there's a problem there. It's illegal. But that hasn't stopped people from Timothy Leary to Steve Jobs from using these drugs to probe for deeper answers to life's questions. Cody Swift has always been interested in those big questions. In college, he gravitated towards psychology, and from there, he only continued his trip down the rabbit hole of the human mind. Christine McManigal brings us his story.
What Cody Swift really wanted to study was the nature of consciousness. The search led him to a program at Seattle University, where he earned a master's degree in existential phenomenological psychology. Soon after, he began exploring a whole different avenue toward understanding human nature.
After I graduated with this degree in psychology, it was then that I had a really formative and seminal journey with mushrooms. I'd had a couple of mushroom trips before then, but it was only after having a degree in psychology that I really understood the potential it had for helping us to understand the nature of the mind and how profound of a tool for psychology it could be. I came upon this article about Charlie Grobe's early research at UCLA giving psilocybin to people with cancer. It was helping people overcome the fear of death, and actually that the mediator was loosening our attachment to the sense of who I am, all our memories, all our roles, and psilocybin gives you a transcendent glimpse beyond that and then helps relieve the fear of death, because those are all the things that are threatened at the end of life. And it was just one of the most important transformative concepts I had ever heard. I had been a hospice worker, actually a hospice volunteer, for a number of years, so I was really interested in death and dying, and I'm almost getting emotional and speaking to it, but in society, there's really no tools that we have other than, I would think, meditation that really give us an experiential training on how to reconcile the fact of death in our lives and in our mortality. There's a lot of people who, existentialists and others, who believe that it's the fear of death that drives the majority of our neuroses and anxieties and compulsion to need to acquire excess in our lives to build up this sort of existential fortress against the fear of death that is causing so many problems in the world. And the fact that there could be this tool that doesn't numb from the face of death, but actually allows people to face it in this very deep way that actually allows a healthy and even enlivened relationship to death. And so that has just been profound and just so touching, really mind-blowing to acknowledge that there's a tool and a therapy that can help people reach those new understandings.
Has your mindset or approach to the concept of death, has that changed since you've been working in this field?
Absolutely. Having subsequently done a lot more psychedelics and have gone through my own personal transformation and journey, intentional ways, I think my own relationship to death has really been affected too.
That research Cody found seemed promising, but it had hardly been followed up on at all. The reason for that is the United States makes it very difficult to study controlled substances. Researchers can forget about federal funding if they want to continue investigating the therapeutic uses of LSD. Cody found that frustrating, and it happens that he was in a position to do something about it. He directs a Kirkland-based foundation run on family money called the River Styx Foundation. Maybe, he reasoned, he could step in and do what traditional funders could not.
So I called up Johns Hopkins and said, hey, look, I have this small family foundation. Just let me know if there's any way that we can help you. And they called back almost immediately and said, actually, it turns out we started the study without any identified sources of funding. And it was just this incredibly synchronistic moment. And so we began funding the trial all the way through its completion.
When you were talking to these patients, the 12 patients that finished the study, what were their responses?
It's interesting. You know, a lot of them were really able to face their death and cancer in a new way. So a lot of them described in this early phase of their psilocybin journey, and I should say these were all guided journeys, so they had the support of therapists, trained therapists, who helped them prepare and who were with them the entire journey to help them go through any difficult moments. And in the first stage of that journey, a lot of them did have some difficulty. And they kind of moved into this dark space where they felt like they were losing control, losing their sense of identity, and it was really scary. But there was something important in that. A lot of them said it really helped them because it wasn't an antidepressant. It allowed them access to those difficult parts in themselves that they may have been avoiding since their diagnosis or even their whole life. And the name of the paper that I wrote was actually Cancer at the Dinner Table. And that was referring to this one woman who had this incredible vision of her cancer. There was this big round dinner table and there was all these seats at the table. And at the table was actually cancer. It was her cancer and she saw it there and it was so curious to her. What is cancer doing at the dinner table? And she realized that, oh, cancer is a part of life. Cancer is a part of my life. It's a part of my life journey. And it's not this terrible thing that I need to kind of shove out and separate from my life. Cancer is a part of everything, and everything is a part of everything. And she just felt completely freed up that her life didn't have to be divided and compartmentalized in these ways. That was an abiding memory and experience that really touched her on an emotional level that carried with her long after the psilocybin was over.
River Styx continues to fund research. They're working with New York University on treating alcoholism with psilocybin and with Johns Hopkins on giving mushrooms to clergymen. They also fund efforts to end the death penalty, reform criminal justice, and invest in Native American cultural preservation. In Greek mythology, the river Styx marks the boundary between life and death, conscious and unconscious. Cody Swift's River Styx Foundation operates at that boundary, funding work that blurs the line.
That story from contributor Christine McManigle. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and our theme today is augmented reality. Amir Afrasiabi had glasses as a kid. No big deal, but he found that he had to constantly get new and more powerful ones, and still he seemed to struggle to see. Amir would later discover that he had a degenerative eye condition called keratoconus. It would eventually reroute the course of his career and his life. But as a young architecture student growing up in Iran, he didn't know any of that yet. He just knew that he'd strain to see the board in class or make out the lines on a computer screen. And if that was puzzling to Amir, it really didn't make sense to his professors.
I couldn't see what the professor writing on the board, so they ended up yelling at me, say, hey, this is not what I'm asking you to do, or where is the line? Can't you just see the line? I have two lines, you just draw one. But the fact was, like, I saw them all as one. I remember at that time my parents were so worried that I'm going to drop off college, so they did their best, taking me to all the doctors. At some point they thought I have MS, so they took me all the CT scan, MRI, and all those. And randomly, one day, my dad took me to this eye surgeon, and he did all these tests. And he was like, I have a good news or bad news for you. And the good news is that you don't have to go to military service, because back home in Iran, everyone needs to go. Every boy needs to go to 2 years mandatory military service unless you have a medical condition like this. And it was like, this is the good news. The bad news is that you can never be a good architect. And that was really hard for me to hear that for like a teenager that just got into architecture. He actually, the first time in his office, he gave me the sample contact lens. And when I wore it, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe there are texture. I remember I was sitting at the office on the chair and looking down, and the tile, I could see the line between the tiles. So I was like, I never knew. I told my dad. My dad was laughing. He thought I'm joking. My brain was trained. My brain was not saying that, hey, I don't see the texture and pattern. I thought, whatever I'm seeing, that's what it is.
So that you just tried that lens on, you didn't go and take it home necessarily?
No, so that was for him. He just wanted to show how hard it is to wear and make me get ready for the whole journey that I have.
And why is it that these types of lenses are particularly uncomfortable and difficult to wear?
So they're called hard contact lenses. They're basically like a piece of glass that you put in your eyes. So your eye by default just want to pop it out because it's like a foreign object. And it has to be like piece of glass because your cornea has this irregular deformed shape that it needs to push it back and force it to shape like a really smooth curved surface.
You want to take just a second to define keratoconus?
Sure. So keratoconus is when your eye, the cornea shape is deformed. The normal cornea is very round, it's normal sphere shape, and the keratoconus has an irregular cone shape. But once you have it, there is no solution for it. So after you're done with glasses, which is the first step, you have to wear contact lenses, hard contact lens. And it gets to the point that you cannot even see with hard contact lenses anymore.
When did you have your first corneal transplant? Was that in Iran still?
Yes, in Iran. I remember we found this doctor had the gold medal of this type of surgery in the world, one of the best doctors.
Do you remember when you were first informed, like, you're going to have this?
Yeah, so I remember when I was wearing my contacts, I went going to a routine eye exam, because with the contacts, you have to go almost every month, because even the power of those and number changes, they have to give you a new one. One time the doctor said, now the cornea is too thin that it's very risky wearing the contact because you can actually scratch the cornea, and once it's torn, it's done. You're going blind. And he was saying, after this point, we have to do the corneal transplant. And it was a really painful mentally to wait, because you have to actually wait for young cornea, and he was explaining to me why he has to wait for maximum like 14 years old, 15 years old person's cornea. And that point to me was like really painful.
Painful why?
Painful emotionally that, okay, I'm waiting for someone to donate his or her eye to me, and that person needs to be young.
And that person needs to be dead, right?
Dead.
Yeah. When you had those new corneas, what difference did it make to you and your vision? Was it very noticeable?
Yes. So after the surgery, you're like, wow, I can see. I can see. So it was normal for about a year, year and a half, but then it started going back to the glasses and contacts again.
Do you remember, besides like the tiles that mm-hmm. you saw that first time you put on the contacts, anything else that you saw that surprised you that you hadn't been aware of, or you just didn't think about that much until
myself,
you
myself, seeing myself in the mirror? The first time that I looked at the mirror, one of the things I noticed was I can see every single hair on my beard in the mirror. And I never noticed that much detail. To me, it was so interesting that this is my face and these are all the details in my face that I can see. And even with the contact lens, you see that with contact lens, but when you take it off, now it's gone again. But having a corneal transplant that basically now it's fixed, it's replaced, now you can see it.
So how did you start to move away from architecture then?
Yeah, so I started as an IT manager in a startup company in Portland while I was studying at Oregon State. And that's where I got so fascinated in the data science and the field of AI. So on the side, I was just educating myself with all the skills that I need to know for AI, because I know that's a field that I want to go in.
And why did you know that? What is it about AI that appeals to you?
Yeah, so it all started when I got into the field of computer vision, which is explaining any image or video to the machine. Why do we go through the hard contact lens, which is like a torture to wear, and also the surgeries, which is even worse? Is there anything that AI can help us? Because that's basically free. It's right there. And I told myself that you're working in AI industry and data science every day. And just imagine it was your work assignment. What if your boss said, hey, your new project right now is to work on this research? Just treat it as that.
What would you imagine the end result being? Would it be a device?
Yeah, I can see multiple options. The environment, you're forcing your eye to see the environment better. What if we force the environment to become how your brain understands? So the monitors of your computer, you can change the pixels the way that your brain understands. If you see everything blurry, you can make de-blur the image for your brain.
So you'd have maybe some glasses that would be making those adjustments?
Not only glasses, you can make adjustments on the pictures on the screen itself. So what if you present the picture the way that your eyes understand it? It's important to me because I want to make sure any kid that go through the same experience that I went, they know that there is a texture and pattern in the world before age of like 20. So I want to make sure or try my best to get to the point that help the younger kids to understand this is not a limitation for your life. You just need one additional tool, and people need to build it for you so you can see the world and continue what you have passion for.
Amir Afrasiabi works in computer vision and AI for an aerospace company. He lives in Seattle. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is augmented reality. When it's done right, virtual reality is a totally immersive experience. Put on those goggles and the real world disappears. It's like the ultimate distraction. Well, back in 2016, when we first aired this story, a couple of researchers in Seattle saw that distraction could actually do a lot of good. And so they're using VR to treat people experiencing severe pain. In this case, the virtual world involves penguins, snowballs, and Paul Simon. But before we get to that, Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing introduces us to Kat Lincecum. She's from Palmer, Alaska, but at this moment, she's in the hospital in Seattle.
Kat is on the 8th floor at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. She's stretched out in bed. Her arms are out to the side. She's had surgery the day before, a skin graft, and she has burns over 20% of her body.
We were having a bonfire, and it exploded and got the whole front side of me horribly burned.
So you wake up here. What was the pain like?
It was excruciating. I was in an extreme amount of pain. I had burns all the way down from my ankles, all the way up my legs, my stomach, my chest, my neck, above and below my eyelids, my arms. It's a pain that no matter what you really do, you can't get away from it.
One of the things that makes a bad burn so nasty is that in order to prevent one from becoming infected, the wound has to be scrubbed and scraped. The skin has to be stretched so that as it heals, it doesn't get tight. People can be maimed permanently if scar tissue isn't stretched as the skin heals. And it's during these treatments or wound care sessions that the pain is often the worst for people like Kat.
We did so much cleaning and scraping on it that there were a couple of times I let out a couple of moans because I'm not gonna kid you, it hurts like hell, big time. And when you come out from under all of that, like the next day, I hurt just as bad as I did the day that the fire took place.
Sometimes patients will undergo anesthesia to get them through wound care. The pain can be that intense, and morphine's often involved. And even though you still feel the pain, morphine makes you not really care that it's there. For some of Kat's wound care sessions, virtual reality goggles, similar to the ones that you'd use for snorkeling but smaller, they go on her face. And then Kat leaves the real world behind and enters Snow World. Snow World is a virtual world of ice and, well, snow. It's designed to be far removed from fire or anything else that's hot and could cause a burn. Players toss snowballs at snowmen and penguins while listening to Paul Simon's Graceland. When Kat plays the game, as nurses scrub her burns clean, she says her stress level actually drops.
The more you focused on the game part of the virtual reality, and you literally kind of step outside of your body.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar.
But that's literally what you're doing, and your mind is no longer focused on all that pain.
I'm on the Graceland.
To explain how all of this is possible, we have to meet Dr. Hunter Hoffman. He's a researcher at the Virtual Reality Center at the University of Washington. Dr. Hoffman has been involved with the development of virtual reality since the early 1990s. And back then, he was developing VR programs that could be used in schools.
One of the things I noticed that was key later was, you know, when the kids were in the virtual world, they were completely gone from the real world. So if you tried to get them, if you tried to talk to them, it was really hard because they were like gone.
Their brains were fully occupied. They were completely distracted. Dr. Hoffman made a mental note of this, and he went on to explore the different ways that virtual reality could help people. He cured a woman's debilitating fear of spiders using VR. And then he got wind of what another colleague was doing with hypnotherapy to treat the horrible pain experienced by burn victims.
I said, how does hypnosis reduce patients' pain? He said, we don't fully understand how it works. It looks like distraction may be playing part of the role of why hypnosis is effective. And I said, distraction, we should try this. Virtual reality is extraordinarily distracting. We should use that. My friend introduced me to Dave Patterson, and Patterson and I have been collaborating for almost 20 years now.
Dr. Hunter came up with the idea for Snow World, and he and Dr. Patterson have been using it with great success on burn victims to treat their pain. You see, processing pain, it requires attention from the brain. And if you can distract the brain by creating that out-of-body experience that Kat was describing, pain and discomfort can be greatly reduced. Dr. Patterson said he didn't know it at the time, but when he was a kid, he asked his father a question that touched on the very research he's doing today.
Yes, I remember fishing with my father when I was really young, and we would fish up in Wisconsin. And I was asking about wasp stings and fishing for muskie. And I asked my dad, I said, if you had a muskie, a big muskie on the hook, and you were stung by a bee, what would you feel? And he said, I wouldn't even notice it.
Because his brain would be totally distracted by the fish on the end of his line. Dr. Patterson and Dr. Hoffman know virtual reality is lowering pain because they've done patient surveys and brain imaging. Areas of the brain that normally light up like a Christmas tree because of pain are noticeably dim when VR is involved. So back to Snow World. Why Graceland? Paul Simon, it turns out, he's a pretty altruistic guy. He started a charity in New York that provides healthcare to kids who are living in poverty. And he heard about the work happening at the lab at UW and stopped by while he was in town for a concert to check it out.
And he was particularly smitten by Snow World.
Paul Simon apparently said that what Snow World needed was music. His music. Dr. Hoffman remembers that Paul Simon specifically recommended the song Graceland.
In some ways, you know, because it's African music, it sort of got a beach, ocean. So it doesn't necessarily match the environment, but it certainly has a very positive kind of vibe to it. And it draws you in whether you like it or not. It's very attention-grabbing.
Snow World is getting an upgrade. On this day, Dr. Hoffman is letting Kat, the patient we met earlier from Palmer, Alaska, try out Snow Canyon. Instead of goggles being placed on her face, this new system uses a headset.
So this is a new version that we wanted to try out.
It's a little challenging because one of Kat's ears is burned.
Can we pull that out just a little bit?
Yeah.
As you slide it down? I think that's all I'd have to do.
Okay, we can. This one's cool because you can move your head around.
Oh, well, that's awesome.
After a few adjustments, she's in the new world of Snow Canyon. It's very similar to Snow World, but a little more realistic looking.
Kat, what do you see?
Oh, there's penguins and like snowmen, and they're on the sides of these cliffs.
For a brief bit of time, Kat is flying through a canyon. But this early prototype, it doesn't use Graceland.
The only part is you got to get rid of that do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, da. You need better background music. Other than that, that thing is perfect.
Dr. Hoffman is telling patients not to worry, but that Paul Simon's music will be added soon.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Sarah Ann Lloyd, Christine McManigle, Ali Ferguson, and Paulette Perhatch. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Here's your homework. Go find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever, and subscribe. For extra credit, you can rate and review us there, too. See you next week when our theme is neither here nor there. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.